Hi everyone and welcome to the Genomics Lab podcast, the podcast about current research in the field of genomics.
We are your hosts, Eleanor Watson and Olivia Grant, two PhD students in the genomics group at the University of Essex.
Join us as we speak to researchers in the field about their current research and their journey into genomics. Hi everyone and welcome to episode 3 of the Genomics Lab. Today we are speaking to Laura, who is a third year PhD candidate at Trinity College Dublin in the School of Genetics and Microbiology. So hi Laura.
Thank you guys for asking me. This is so fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming on. It's so exciting to talk to you today about your research. Let's get started. Maybe you could just introduce yourself a little bit, tell us a little bit about you and your research and everything in between.
Yeah, perfect. No worries. So like you said, my name's Laura. I'm 25 years old. I'm a third year PhD candidate at Trinity College Dublin. My research focuses on inherited blindness, specifically any type of inherited blindness affecting the retina where your photoreceptors are. I'm in my third year. I feel like I just said that, but anyway, genetics is the thing I'm interested in most in the world. I really love it. But outside of research, I suppose I have a real interest in makeup and fashion, specifically fashion history. And when the gyms were open, I was really into fitness too, but can't do that anymore. So that's just a little bit of background about me. Yeah.
Nice.
At what point did you realize that you were interested in biology? And then what point did you realize that you was interested in genetics specifically?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know, but I know the school systems between Ireland and the UK are obviously a little bit different. But in Ireland, what you do is in your last 2 years of school, you pick around anywhere between 6 and 8 subjects to study. Some of them are compulsory, some of them aren't. So I chose to study biology and chemistry as some of my subjects, and I had a very interesting biology teacher that always kind of went outside of the curriculum that we needed to learn and told us loads of extras, and he had like a keen interest in genetics.
Nice.
So that's where I really liked biology. I loved all my subjects at school. I was really not a kind of a pick and choose person. I think if I do biology, I would have done something like English. Maybe, or I even liked business as well. I love loads of different things, but anyway, I picked biology. And I studied that for my leaving cert. Your leaving cert are your final exams in school in Ireland. And then I decided that genetics was where I wanted to go. So I looked at all the universities in Ireland and I said, which ones offer genetics courses specifically? And there are a couple, but at the time, Trinity, where I am now doing my PhD, had a 4-year direct entry course in human genetics. So I applied for that. The course doesn't actually exist anymore, which makes me really sad. So now what you do instead, which I think is similar to other universities, is you do something general like science or biomedical science. And after 2 years, you specialize in genetics. But my degree was 4 years straight of genetics. Now it was very similar to the science degrees anyway, but we just did extra genetics. And it was a really small course. There was only 18 people in it. Or in and around that anyway. It changed throughout the years then afterwards. But yeah, I really loved it. So that's kind of how I got into genetics. My biology
interesting.
Was interesting.
So because it was 4 years, did you do like a placement year or anything? Because obviously like ours are normally 3 years. You can do 4 years if you're doing like a placement year or,
or
year
an integrated or master's.
Yeah.
So I think most degrees in Ireland are 4 years now. Most basic degrees.
I didn't know that.
Level eights, yeah. You can definitely do 3-year degrees, and I could have chosen to have done a 3-year degree, but it only would have been a level 7, I think, instead of a level 8 degree. And you needed a level 8 degree to do another degree afterwards. So most are 4 years. It depends. In Ireland, we have universities and then Institute of Technology as well. And I think maybe some Institute of Technology have 3-year degrees, but universities have 3-year degrees, 3-year degrees too. But all my friends and me and everybody, we all did 4 years.
Wow. Okay. It's a little bit different to we've got here in the UK then.
Yeah, it is a little bit. And I didn't do a master's. So you here you don't have to do a master's. I think you don't have to in the UK either.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I haven't done a master's either.
Yeah, so I didn't do a master's. And a lot of the people around here may not have done master's as well.
Interesting. Just a little bit like off track.
Yeah.
How do you think, like, what are your opinions on not doing a master's before doing a PhD, because I'm of the opinion of like, when I first started the PhD, I was like, it doesn't matter, like you don't really need it. But I feel like the longer I'm doing my PhD, the more I sort of wish like, oh, like would things be a little bit easier had I have done a master's?
Yeah, see, the thing is I don't know, because, you know, I never did the master's.
Yeah.
I imagine like you grow up a little bit and you get a little bit better at research and you get a bit more independent than you would have been as an undergrad. And I imagine that really stands to you in your later years, or even just when you begin your PhD, you know, you're lost, like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
I'd say if I did a master's, it might have made me a little bit more mature for sure. But I don't mind that I didn't have that year to, or 2 years to do that.
I guess you got an extra year of undergrad compared to.
Well, I mean, I was 23 when I started my PhD as well. So I don't think I was super young or anything.
No.
Yeah. So we did have the 4 years exactly. So maybe that kind of made up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So okay. you've done your undergrad and now you're obviously doing your PhD at the same university. Same as me.
Yeah.
We have a lot of similarities here. So how did you sort of like, did you hear about the lab? Obviously you must have heard about the lab that you're working in now. Mm-hmm. Did you do like an undergrad project in there, or how did you sort of like get into the lab, I guess?
I think this is similar to you as well, actually. So first, I guess my PI here, her name is Jane Farr. She was a lecturer of mine all the way through my undergrad, and I found her research super interesting. So when we had the chance to apply for our final year projects that we did for 10 weeks, I applied to be in her lab, which is this lab. And I did my final year project on a really, really cool project. It was all about gene therapies for inherited retinal diseases, specifically focusing on CRISPR, which was super cool. I really enjoyed it. And Kira, who's a member of our lab here, was my supervisor, and she was super nice and really friendly. And it just so happened that there was a PhD position coming up in the lab this September after I finished my degree.
Yeah, very similar. Andy? Similar to me, very similar.
Exactly. So Jane asked me if I'd be interested in joining the lab, and it just kind of went from there.
That's great.
It was nice. It was kind of nice. It was before I finished my degree, so it was nice to not feel like super rushed into trying to pick something, and I had been in the lab already, and so it was like,
Is it? Because you sort of like, you sort of know everyone, like, so actually very similar, because my undergraduate project, the one of my supervisor's PhD students was also sort of supervising us, so I already knew someone in the lab, and it definitely like just makes it a little bit less scary because you're already familiar with like the environment and people in the lab and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I guess that's a like a difference that we had, isn't it, Liv? Obviously you hadn't done your master's, but you did know everyone already. Essex was already familiar to you.
Yeah.
It was all completely new to me, but I'd done the master's. So I guess we were kind of a little bit more on a level playing field there, in that we both kind of knew some things and also hadn't got a clue about others.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, okay. Did you give us a like just a brief overview of your PhD research then?
Yeah, no problem. So like I said, when I did my final year project, I did work on inherited retinal diseases as well, but it was on the gene therapy and the treatment side of things. So now my PhD more so focuses on what's actually causing these inherited retinal diseases, specifically what are the genes and what are the variants in those genes that cause inherited retinal disease. So I work on a project called Target 5000. Target 5000 is the Irish National Registry for Inherited Retinal Diseases, and it's a sequencing project. So we enroll patients who the ophthalmologists think have some form of inherited retinal disease, and we sequence their DNA to try and find the specific genetic changes different to healthy controls that could be causing the disease. And it's kind of, as I hate to say, as basic as that, do you know what I mean? It's not as simple in practice, but it is, it is as simple as that. So finding the DNA changes that cause inherited retinal disease.
Okay, and what kind of got you interested in this research? I mean, obviously you said about doing your undergraduate project within this sort of lab environment. Was that where your interest kind of came from, or is there anything else that influenced you to kind of want to study this?
Yeah, so like I said, my PI was always a lecturer, and I was just immediately drawn to what she did, and she was a really great teacher. But in my third year of my undergrad degree as well, I did an internship in a different lab in a different university in Ireland. It was in University College Dublin, And I did an internship in a lab that focused on drug treatments for types of blindness as well. Mm-hmm. And they used zebrafish as a model. And that was really cool because I got to work with a model, and it was a little bit different to what I had done throughout my degree because my degree was very genetics based. Mm-hmm. So I tried to move a little bit outside that to research that was a little bit away from genetics. And I really liked it, and I still found anything to do with the eye really interesting. And then I guess I realized when I went into my final year that I really did want to stick with something very genetics-y, and I don't think I could have found a more genetics-y project. And I guess with whatever I wanted to do, I wanted to do something that would definitely directly help people. I wanted to work in any capacity with patient data that I could, and I wanted to feel like every day I was doing something that, you know, might help somebody. So yeah, that's how I got into it. It was just because it was super genetics and to do with people as well. Yeah,
I was going to say, it sort of comes off our conversation last week about how people have a preference for human or plant data. Or...
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So maybe we should, or if you should, if you don't mind, sort of like outline what are inherited retinal diseases. What exactly are they?
Yeah, so an inherited retinal disease is a type of disease that causes a visual impairment because something has gone wrong with the retina. And the retina is made up of loads of different cells that contribute to actually forming your vision. So mainly your photoreceptor cells that take in light. And then so if anything happens to them, it could potentially cause a certain form of blindness. So that's what an inherited retinal disease is. We say they're inherited because they might show certain characteristics that make the ophthalmologist think that it's inherited through generations in a family. So there might be prior family history, or it might affect both eyes or something like that. So that's what an inherited retinal disease is.
Yeah. Okay. Is that the name for, so obviously it's a group of diseases. Is there any like examples that
we
might have heard of? It, like, I don't want to sound really stupid here, but is something like glaucoma an example of?
So glaucoma wouldn't be a retinal disease because it doesn't specifically affect the retina, but it definitely can be inherited, or certain forms of it can be inherited in a way. There are definitely variants that can increase your risk of glaucoma or cause glaucoma. IRD's inherited retinal disease is a huge umbrella term. There are so many different diseases that can fall underneath it. So one of the biggest one that we deal with is called retinitis pigmentosa. And it's basically when your photoreceptors start to die from the outside in, and they create this kind of tunnel vision because it affects primarily the rod photoreceptors. So that's one example. Another example is Stargardt disease, which is a macular dystrophy. So it affects the center of the retina and your central vision. So they can affect different parts of the retina, and they have very different phenotypes. They have really different physical presentations. And I could go on and on and list probably. Maybe there's not that many IRDs. So there's loads. And we see loads of them that come in. They're very different, all of them.
So do we know exactly what causes IRDs? Like, what you mentioned, obviously, like photoreceptor cells. Mm-hmm. Do we know what actually happens to these cells, sort of the molecular events that occur?
Yeah, it all depends on the gene that's mutated. So retinitis pigment, or just IRDs in general, over 270 genes have been associated with IRDs, and those 270 genes probably all do different things, you know, or code for different proteins that do different things. So for example, rhodopsin is a gene that causes dominant retinitis pigmentosa, and it plays a really important role in the visual cycle. There's loads of different things. There's loads of different ones. Again, ABCA4 that causes Stargardt's disease is important in the visual cycle as well.
Are these, so this again might be a stupid question. Are these photoreceptor cells, are they dying? Are they like?
Yeah, that's a tough question. So the actual molecular, what happens is not particularly my area of expertise. That was more like what I did for my internship, let's say. Mm-hmm. So absolutely though. So whatever happens, it could be a structural component of the photoreceptor that isn't coded for properly, and then it won't form properly, or it degenerates over time, that kind of thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so how do IRDs affect people's kind of quality of life? Obviously there's the obvious, like have trouble seeing answers, but like how many people roughly are affected?
So we call our project Target 5000. Sorry about the cars in the background. I'm gonna wait for
that's okay.
we call our project Target 5000 because there's an estimated 5000 people in Ireland who have an inherited retinal disease. I think globally it's a very approximate 2 million people, something like that. So they are rare diseases. And then I think globally the incidence is something like 1 in 4,000.
Okay.
Yeah, and how do they affect people's quality of life? I think that's a really great question. And it's not something I can directly say, you know, every person who has an IRD is probably affected in their own different way, and their own lived experience is the important thing. But of course, like you said, having a visual impairment affects your independence, your mobility, your mental health, even just the cost of an illness. A lot of the cost of the illness is borne by the person or their families who have it. And so it definitely does have a large effect on someone's quality of life. But in saying that, you know, people who have inherited retinal diseases go on and do amazing things with their life. You know, I know a lady who just finished her master's. I know another girl who's a Paralympian. And I think it's really important that we make everything accessible to people who have inherited retinal diseases as well, because as much as, you know, there's work being done on treatments and stuff, it's important that we try and improve everybody's quality of life as much as we can.
Yeah, of course. And on the subject of treatments, absolutely. is there any hope for any treatment for IRDs?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I was saying, the other half of our lab work on treatments for inherited retinal diseases. They work on gene therapy specifically. But I can give you an actual real world example of treatment for an IRD, and that's called Luxturna. It's a gene replacement therapy. So these individuals have an IRD called Leber congenital amaurosis. And it's a very, very early onset form and can be quite severe form of inherited retinal disease. And Luxturna, what it does is this disease is caused by biallelic variants in the RPE65 gene. And the gene therapy, what it does is it replaces the not functioning gene, basically. It delivers via a virus a working copy of the gene and helps to restore vision. So that treatment is actually already approved by the EMA and the FDA. I think only very recently it was approved on the NHS and people were treated on the NHS. With that treatment, so that's really nice. It's not yet approved here in Ireland, but we are lobbying our government for that. So there is actually a treatment out there already helping people's sight for who have an IRD, and then there's lots of similar treatments in the works as well, and then there's other approaches as well. So I work specifically on non-coding variants in these genes that cause IRDs, and a really promising treatment for that is something called an antisense oligonucleotide. It's basically like a plaster that goes in on top of the variant and stops the splicing machinery from splicing in the wrong way, because non-coding variants often affect the splicing process. So I think a lot of those kind of treatments are in clinical trial as well. So there are lots of promising treatments for IRDs.
Well, it's really interesting and really exciting, I guess, isn't it?
I think it's really cool as well that you can go and replace a gene and you know, helps. It's amazing to think about, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned just then non-coding DNA. Just being aware of some listeners who probably, you know, might be, you know, just starting their undergrad. What is non-coding DNA? So this is quite a difficult question and a controversial one, but what is the function of non-coding DNA?
Yeah, so in your genes, you've got your coding DNA and your non-coding DNA. So your coding DNA, also known as your exonic DNA, is DNA that directly codes to make parts of proteins. And then your non-coding DNA, or your intronic DNA, is the bits in between. And for a long time, it was kind of thought that they don't really have a function, that they don't really do much. But more and more, we're finding out that there are different maybe enhancer elements or things like that within introns that do have an effect on gene expression or different things like that. And what I focus on is the splicing process. So splicing is when you take your gene and you take out those intronic or non-coding bits, so the protein can be coded from the exons. But that process can go wrong. And if that process goes wrong, then the protein that's made in the end is going to be different from the protein you expect. And that can cause disease then. So I work on variants that cause cryptic or splice sites that aren't supposed to be there. And they might include extra exons where they shouldn't, or they might make an exon longer than it should be or shorter than it should be. And any change to that exon structure is going to have a change on the protein structure. So those are the kind of DNA changes that I'm particularly interested in.
Okay. And so kind of thinking about the genetics of IRDs, what sort of inheritance underlies them? Are they autosomal, recessive, dominant? What, tell us a bit about the inheritance of these diseases.
They are everything.
Everything, okay.
this is the thing about IRDs again, is like I said, the phenotypes are so different. There's so many different genes, and because there's so many different genes, there's so many different inheritance patterns. So
okay.
You can get dominant IRDs like retinitis pigmentosa. You can get recessive IRDs like Stargardt disease. You can get mitochondrial forms like LHON, and the mitochondrial forms just means that the variant might be in the mitochondrial genome as opposed to the nuclear genome. And I think I mentioned in the paper that you guys read that there's digenic forms as well. So that means, yes. So there's seldom, not seldom, there's very few reports of digenic inheritance, I think, but loads of different inheritance patterns basically, and it's really useful to know what the suspected inheritance pattern is, because then we can kind of narrow down the list of genes we need to look at.
Yeah,
right. And I was going to ask actually, just so depending on the type of inheritance of the disease, the particular disease, is there like, do you see differences or sort of like a correlation with maybe extremity of the disease, or like on maybe like age onset of the disease and things like that?
So again, to add another layer of complexity,
it's all very complex.
The thing about this as well is that it's not only the genes that are affected, but the actual variants within those genes. So there definitely is certain severity associated with certain genes and certain inheritance patterns, but even within a gene, different variants can cause more or less of a severe disease, basically. So even though two people might have variants, for example, in ABCA4 that causes Stargardt disease, one might have a way earlier onset just because of the particular variant that they have. So perhaps maybe they have what we call a null variant, and that can be really severe because it won't create any functional protein product. But someone else might have a missense variant, and a missense variant might result in some functional protein product. So that person might have a less severe disease. So it all depends. It depends on the gene, and it depends on the actual changes within that gene. So they all come together to kind of tell us how severe a disease might be.
Sounds like really complex and tough research to
pursue.
So you mentioned that there's 270 genes associated with IRD overall. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that you can like sub-categorize? So for example, are there maybe 10 of those genes that are associated with one type of IRD, or is there like a large overlap between the genes?
There can be kind of an overlap, but there definitely is like categories for sure. So RP, retinitis pigmentosa, is a tough one because I think almost over 70 genes or something can cause retinitis pigmentosa. But like I was talking about Stargardt disease, 90% of the time that's caused by changes in ABCA4. And then what's another type of disease? Usher syndrome, for example, is a form of syndromic IRD. And a syndromic IRD means that it's not only the eyes that might be affected. So people with Usher syndrome can have deafness as well. So there are certain genes like USH2A or USH1C that can be involved in Usher syndrome. So we can definitely categorize things for sure. Yeah. And you get so used to looking at these that you kind of learn off in your head which gene is associated with what. So you'll see, oh, there's ABCA4. I know that that's associated with Stargardt disease.
And so how were the first IRD genes discovered?
It's really cool. It's kind of like a history lesson because a lot of that actually happened in this department. So my PI, Jane, who I mentioned earlier, worked as part of the team who discovered some of the first IRD genes, and they were discovered through linkage analysis. So they took these really big, massive families who had, you know, affected people and unaffected people. And we're talking big Irish families with loads of different cousins and loads of different aunts and uncles and children. And they did linkage analysis, which is basically based on the observation that genes that are close together on a chromosome are linked during meiosis. And so then over generations, you look at certain regions segregating with the disease as opposed to not with the disease in the unaffected people, and you can narrow down the region on the chromosome where that gene is through different genetic markers.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I feel like I've always heard the term linkage analysis, but I've never really known exactly how it works. But that's actually really cool. And it's so cool that you're now like working in the lab.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So the people that I guess they done the linkage analysis on, mm-hmm. were they also involved in the Target 5000, or is that quite a recent sort of study? Or
so this linkage analysis would have been done 30 or so years ago for sure. Mm-hmm. So it would have preceded Target 5000. So Target 5000 only came about when next generation sequencing became really available, and you know, accessible, because it can be very expensive. So the linkage analysis would have been done before that for sure. But we would have people who are descendants of the people who are in the linkage analysis studies joining Target 5000.
Cool. Tell us a little bit more about Target 5000. Like, what can you tell us about it in terms of like age ranges, how many people are involved in it and things like that? It sounds like a really, like, for this kind of research, really useful study for you.
Did it kind of originate from kind of your institute?
Yes, it did. So it's all been done in this lab, Target 5000, sequencing the IRD population in Ireland. And it's a big, massive collaboration. So it's a collaboration with the clinicians as well in the different hospitals in Dublin that deal with these things, as well as Fighting Blindness Ireland. They're a charity who have done immense work in this and, you know, fund this project as well. They fund my PhD, and the members of Target 5000 who are, you know, in Target 5000. Oh my God, I'm messing up my words now. The members of Fighting Blindness Ireland who are in Target 5000 as well, have, you know, contributed immensely to this work. It's a sequencing study. So what we do is we typically do target capture next generation sequencing, which means we pick out a panel of genes that we know are associated with inherited retinal diseases. So previously associated in the literature, and we sequence the exons of those genes. And that's kind of like the first pass measure in sequencing these people, because we can solve a lot of cases that way. So we have a 70% positive diagnosis rate. So that was from our most recent analysis. So to date, we've sequenced over 1,000 people in Ireland who have IRDs.
What is the average sort of age in the people involved in the Target 5000 study? And how does that sort of correlate with, I probably should have asked this earlier, but how, like, sort of what is the age of onset, I guess, average age of onset of IRD? So like, are people born with them, or is it something that they sort of get maybe in their 50s?
Yeah, and I guess, are the volunteer or the people that you're studying as part of Target 5000, are they kind of representative of that age distribution?
Yeah, so we have people from all ages that are in our study. We have anybody of any age can enroll, and we have children all the way up to very elderly people in our study. If I was to give you an average age, I don't think that average age would be representative of the fact that we have people that are so many different ages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I guess, and your question about what's the kind of average age of onset for IRD, it's hard to give an average age of onset for all IRDs, you know.
Yeah.
IRDs have different ages of onset. So mm-hmm. retinitis pigmentosa, depending on how severe the variants are, can be early onset or late onset. Again, Stargardt disease can be early onset, so maybe in kind of early teens to late onset, much later in life, again, depending on the variant. And there are forms that come really young, like Leber congenital amaurosis. I think I was talking about that earlier. That's a very, very early age of onset. So again, depends on the phenotype, depends on the genes, and depends on the very
everything.
Must make it such an interesting but kind of difficult area to study, because there's so many branches
interesting. And the other thing is, these are really rare diseases. Some of the people that we see are the only people in Ireland with a certain gene causing their disease, or certain, how do I put that better? Some of the people in our study are the only people who have a certain variant causing that disease in Ireland, or even in the whole world. Some of them might be the only people in the world with that particular variant. So it's difficult to kind of determine their disease progression and the severity of their disease, because we have no one to compare them to.
Yeah, of course.
So a big thing now for IRDs is these kind of studies trying to gather lots of people who have the same variants and seeing how their disease progresses over time and maybe what that will mean for other people who have the same variants in the future. So while it's, you're right, like it's hard, especially when we're talking about kind of age of onset and stuff like that. Yeah, so that's kind of a little bit about Target 5000.
So in terms of the Target 5000 study, were you looking to discover like novel variants of genes? Were you looking to validate previous findings? Did you kind of, were you expecting to find new things and were able to, or?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I guess the primary aim is always to get a genetic diagnosis for our patient. Yeah. It's always the primary aim.
Yeah.
We find interesting kind of genetics-y things in between, that's great as well. So did we expect to find novel variants? I guess you don't go in saying we're definitely going to find novel variants, but you know, every country can have a really unique genetic architecture. So in, it's not totally surprising that there might be variants in Ireland that aren't anywhere else.
Yeah.
Especially considering that we're in Ireland. But at the same time, you know, we do expect definitely a lot of similarity to other countries as well, just because of the nature of these diseases. But it wasn't surprising that we found novel variants at all. And novel variants are tricky because there are guidelines to say whether a variant is pathogenic or not. So another part of our job is deciding if, you know, something is actually disease causing. And there are some guidelines called the ACMG guidelines by the American College of Genetics and Genomics, I think, or the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics. And basically they're a set of rules that you follow to score up a variant and decide if it's pathogenic. And the different criteria are things like, has there been functional analysis of the variant? What type of variant is it? Does it segregate with the disease in the family? All these different things. And we have to go through those guidelines and score up these variants as well. And novel variants are hard because you can't really get very good population frequencies a lot of the time, or there hasn't been work done on these variants. They're not seen in anyone else. So how can you say that something is pathogenic if you don't see it in lots of people who have the disease? And there are certain ways to do it, but it's hard.
Yeah,
sure. Makes sense. Okay, so how, I guess, like, I'm interested more in the particular like methods of your work. So obviously you're using this Target 5000 study, you're sequencing these people, like how, what sort of, I guess, downstream analysis do you do after that to actually say this gene is, or this variant is linked to this disease, for example?
Yeah. So like you said, we do the sequencing and we sequence the panel. And then we get back that data and we align it to the reference genome and we look for any differences. And so then we call out the variants. And first step, I suppose, is filtering out variants that are probably benign. And these are kind of variants that are too common to be variants that cause a rare disease. So we look at different databases to do that.
Do you have to, like, I guess, so you say that you like will align it to a reference genome and mm-hmm. sort of look for differences.
Yeah.
Do you have to account for like anything? I don't know, again, if this might be a really stupid question, but do you have to account for things like maybe, I guess like confounding factors, do you have to account for other things, or can you sort of look at those differences and then say like, okay, this is definitely related to this disease?
Yeah, so what our pipeline does is essentially it gives us a short list of variants. So it's filtered out the ones that are too common and things like that. And then what we can do is we can look at them and say, okay, this person has this phenotype. We know that these genes are associated with that, or changes in these genes are associated with that phenotype. So in that sense, you can rule out some other variants because it doesn't correlate with the phenotype. You always have to have a genotype-phenotype correlation. And then the other thing is looking at the inheritance pattern. So if something is recessive, we're looking for two variants because we need to see that something is affecting both alleles. If something is dominant, we're just looking for one dominant variant. If something's X-linked, we're looking for something on the X chromosome. So the family history can give us a lot of detail into what we're looking for. So really, it's just important to match up the genotype with the phenotype.
So how do you measure like a genotype phenotype correlation?
I guess there's work done beyond that. So beyond what we do, so genes will have been associated with the specific form of IRD that you're dealing with already. And different types of functional analysis will have been done on those genes, or there might be knockout models of the certain disease with those genes knocked out. And so then we know that this gene is definitely associated with this disease. So then see a variant within that gene, we know that maybe this variant is perturbing the protein that this gene makes in some way. Yeah. And then we can look it up and we can see if this variant has been seen before. And if this variant has been seen before and has been seen in lots of people who have the specific inherited retinal disease that our patient has, then we can say that looks like a good candidate.
Yeah.
That was a great answer. So
yeah, thank you.
That's okay.
I see like a lot of your, so to me in my head, a lot of this work is sounding more bioinformatics based, but I see a lot like, you know, on your Instagram that you're like doing things in the lab. So what kind of things are you like getting up to in the lab? Because I am just picturing all of this as you sat at your computer doing bioinformatics.
Yeah, so that's the nice thing about my project. There's a bit of dry work and a bit of wet work. So the thing is, after all of this sequencing happens and we find good candidates, we do Sanger sequencing then on the patients and their families. And that's, you know, you have to do some wet work to do that. So I do a lot of PCR where I amplify the region that the variant is in and then I sequence it. And it's just double checking to make sure that that variant is present and it's present in the affected members of the family and not in the unaffected ones. We also, we do segregation analysis within the family. So for example, if you have a recessive disease, like I said before, you have to know that both alleles are affected. So if we've got a proband, and a proband is the first person recruited to a genetic study. If we've got the proband and they have retinitis pigmentosa and they have variants in RPE65, let's say that gene, and they have one on each allele, or we're trying to see if they have one on each allele, we need to look at their parents or their children. So let's just say we're looking at their parents. We need to see that they got one from their mom and one from their dad, so we know that they're on different alleles. If they got both from dad, they're both on the same allele, so they can't be causing the recessive disease because there's still one wild type allele or one healthy allele left.
Yeah.
So that's part of my wet work, is doing that kind of segregation analysis on the families, so bigger family studies. And then I also do functional analysis of non-coding variants. So non-coding variants are different to exonic or coding variants, because when something affects an exon, you can kind of, there's different avenues you can explore to how that variant affects the protein, because it is most likely affecting the protein if it's rare and if it looks like a pathogenic variant, because it's in the exon and that directly codes for the protein. But if something's in an intron, then you don't know if it's directly affecting the protein. It might just be in a bit of an intron that doesn't do very much.
Yeah.
So I do first in silico analysis to predict if those variants have an effect on splicing. And then I kind of make a model in cells to do the splicing process that, and then I transfect plasmids that have the variants in those genes and I see if there's an effect on the splicing process. So lots of my wet work is to do with analyzing splice variants.
God, that's so cool. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah. Very well-rounded project.
It actually really is. And honestly, it sounds like really interesting and really like comprehensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cool. How do you see if something is having an effect on splicing? So how do you know that a variant is actually affecting splicing? I'm taking it back to bioinformatics.
Let's start with the in silico stuff. So the computer stuff where we predict. So there are certain software that you can use that you can put in a variant and it'll give you some data on whether that variant looks like it might affect the splicing process. And this is all done through different things like machine learning, neural networks, matrices, all these different things. And it'll give you a readout and you can say, okay, it's got a score of this. So that score indicates that it might affect splicing. So let's take that into the lab and let's make a model that recapitulates that splicing process. So we make a plasmid that has, it represents a wild type person. And then we make a plasmid that represents our patient. We transfect those plasmids into cells. We let splicing happen. And then we check the transcript at the end, and maybe the transcript in the affected person is shorter or longer than the one in the wild type person. And so we know that that variant actually has a qualitative effect on the protein.
That's really interesting. So do you find, so obviously there's lots of different methods of inheritance of these diseases, as we discussed earlier. Do you find different genes dependent on what kind of inheritance is seen in these diseases? And do you know why that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm realizing now as I'm explaining this to you guys how much you learn off as you do a project like this, that you just pick up and know. So there are different databases. For example, RetNet is one. It's a website called RetNet, and you can look up a gene in RetNet, and it'll tell you if it's associated with all the different IRDs it's associated with. So if it's associated with a recessive IRD, a dominant IRD, things like that. And then the thing about, so what it is is that, let's take dominant diseases, for example. So dominant diseases can result from a number of different ways. So maybe, you know, perturbing one allele is enough to not have enough protein function. So maybe you need more than 50% protein. So that's how the dominant disease might manifest itself. The other thing is that the dominant protein, the dominant is a dominant negative effect. So the protein that's made as a result of the dominant variant might attack the wild type protein as well, and that can degrade that, and then dominant disease can manifest that way. So that's haploinsufficiency and dominant negative disease. And then recessive disease is generally to do with not having enough protein made.
Just interested in discussing some of the results from the paper. So what, I guess, like what variants did you like discover, and were they novel, or like were they sort of like, I know Ellie asked earlier sort of a similar question, but what did you validate, or were they novel findings?
So we found variants that we found before that we might have seen previously in different studies, and then we also found novel variants. I think it could have been 19 novel variants we found as well, and like I said previously, our diagnostic yield was about 70%, which is in line with other similar studies. It's a little bit on the higher end of things. The novel variants we're working on, because like I mentioned previously, they take a little bit of extra work to prove that they're pathogenic. Some of them might be variants of unknown significance, and we need to decide if they're pathogenic, because if they're not, then we have to go back and look again, because they might not be the cause. We had such a massive clinical spectrum that presented in our study. We had, you know, rare IRDs like retinoschisis, and then really more common IRDs like retinitis pigmentosa. And I'm trying to think, we found a really interesting whole gene deletion of a gene called CHM, which is X-linked. And what was interesting was even the female carriers had a phenotype. We found a phenotype, this is very IRD related, I suppose, but we found a phenotype that was a result of ABCA4 variants that typically cause Stargardt disease. And these individuals did have Stargardt disease, but they also had some kind of something that looked a little bit like RP as well, or had progressed so much that the Stargardt is a macular disease, so that the periphery had been affected as well. So that was interesting. We also found some extra cases of, previously my supervisor Adrian had published on variants in a gene called FLVCR1 that are typically associated with syndromic retinitis pigmentosa as well. They present with ataxia as well as retinitis pigmentosa, but we have found a variant in our study that just results in retinitis pigmentosa as a result of variants in FLVCR1, and we found some extra cases of that as well. So definitely a mix of findings we had found before and also new variants and things that might be quite rare, like that big deletion,
which is like the perfect result.
Yeah.
Validate and you find new stuff. That's so cool.
Yeah, that is. So the majority of causes at the moment you found to be in exonic regions.
Exactly, yeah. And then after that we look at the introns, because that's what we haven't looked at previously.
And it's a lot harder, I guess. So you do that as your kind of your second.
I guess you don't typically sequence for non-coding regions, because as you just mentioned, typically the cause, or you know, most of the time the cause is in the exonic regions. And then sequencing introns is expensive because they're huge. Whole genome sequencing is really, really expensive. We are part of a study now that sequences the whole of the ABCA4 gene that causes Stargardt disease. The gene is 128 kb. It's huge. So that's a really cost-effective method, because it just sequences one gene. Mm-hmm. But if we were going to do whole genome sequencing on everybody, it would be very expensive. So
yeah, focus on the exons. It's not feasible.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully in the future. But yeah, focus on the exons first. If we don't find something in the exons, we move to the introns.
Okay, so like, what are the, I guess, like, what are the benefits of, so obviously there's people involved in this Target 5000 study. What are the benefits of your research to them individually?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like I said, this study is really all about the people who are in it. Mm-hmm. And we really do want to benefit them. So there are loads of benefits to being in a sequencing study. So I guess I can start off with, you can actually get a more accurate diagnosis. So your clinician might say, this disease looks like this, and it looks like people I've seen before with this IRD, but let's find the genetic cause and that will confirm it. Does that make sense? That's kind of like a confirmation. And then patients will know specifically what kind of disease they have. They can, you know, go to specific support groups for that particular disease. And then the other thing is that for these gene therapies that I was talking about, often to enroll in clinical trials or in the future when they become available, you have to have variants in the gene that those gene therapies are for, and that has to be known in advance. So to access future treatment, it would be important for someone to have a genetic diagnosis. The other thing is, you know, managing your disease progression, both for the clinician and the patient. So the clinician might have a better idea of how the disease is going to progress if someone has a genetic diagnosis. And then there's family planning as well. People might decide to do different things once they have a genetic diagnosis. And lots of people feel empowered by having a genetic diagnosis, and they feel it's really worthwhile to know the actual specific cause of the type of blindness that they have.
So it must be really rewarding for you knowing that your research, I mean, obviously everyone hopes that their research will go on to benefit people, but you can obviously see that it's having a direct, kind of almost immediate impact on people, which must be really, really rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. The charity who funds my research, Fighting Blindness Ireland, holds a public and patient engagement day every year. So it's really nice to see people presenting at that, mm-hmm. or people talking at that, and seeing and meeting the patients themselves and talking to them, and how they feel about, you know, enrolling in the genetic study and things like that. So it is really, really, it's a really rewarding study, and it's exactly what I wanted to do. It's always exactly what I wanted to do, which really sounds really cringy, but it really, it's exactly the kind of project I wanted to do. So it's really nice to know. And sometimes it's weird to think I'm looking at a person here when I'm looking at this four-letter code, you know, but it's great to always have that in the back of your mind. And it's really nice to know that when you're giving information back to the clinic, that eventually a patient will hear that information as well. So,
is really nice. It's so lovely. It must actually be like so lovely. And I think some people, like, going into research, like you, for example, you are like, have always been and will probably always be really keen on like working closely with like clinicians and mm-hmm. things like that. But also, you know, like all of these, like for me, for example, I'm not like too bothered about that, because I think, you know, these people who have built, like, for example, you know, you mentioned about these neural networks and these machine learning methods that you use to look at the splicing and stuff. Mm-hmm. Obviously, all the people who, you know, develop these packages, I think sometimes it's hard to know, like, okay, why am I developing this package? Like, what is the point in it? But like listening to, I guess, like stories like yours and hearing about your research, it sort of like highlights also how important that research is as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, there, I think everybody has their role in every
aspect. Yeah, yeah.
You've got to have the people who are making these tools. You've got to have the people who are doing the, you know, assays, the cellular assays. You've got to have people who are working with animal models. You've got to have people who are making treatments. You've got to have everybody. And it's really nice that there are different people who are interested in all those different things, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone has like their own things that they really want to get out of their research.
Exactly.
But like, yeah, it helps you, I guess, to like connect all the dots between like everyone in genomics.
Exactly. Yeah. So which it's is really nice. Kind of probably what your podcast is for. I mean, is that, you know, exposing everybody to the different types of genomics that there is. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So what are your hopes for the future of your field, your research, the project as a whole?
Mm-hmm. My main hopes are, like I mentioned previously, is to work on that 30% of people that we don't find a genetic diagnosis for, and to do better and to find a genetic diagnosis. So whether that takes a different form of sequencing or a different form of functional analysis in the wet lab, or even, like you're saying, coming up with different kind of programs to predict different effects of different variants. So I guess in the field of IRDs, we are very well aware that there is this kind of Mendelian inheritance pattern for a lot of IRDs. But as we kind of move into the future, I think we're seeing that there are different modifying factors and things like that. And there are so many things that we don't even know about yet. And it's really humbling to know that there's a lot more to find out. So I hope in the future that we can do more comprehensive sequencing on the people we don't find things with the preliminary sequencing, and that new tools are made to make the data analysis part of that more simple.
What has been the most challenging part of your research, whether it's like wet lab or maybe, I guess, what's been the most challenging part of your PhD in general? So like, have you struggled most with, I guess, the content or like the actual knowledge, or I don't know, like managing your time? Like, what's been the biggest struggle for you?
I think that's a really great question. I can't wait to like listen to what everybody else says to this. from a project like specific perspective, the most challenging thing has been, I suppose, it's just, I think what every PhD faces is that experiments just don't work sometimes, and you have to troubleshoot them, and you have to spend months, you know, making something work. And I find that really challenging because I'm a bit of a perfectionist, you know. I'm just like, why is this not working? And I try X amount of things and that kind of thing. So I suppose from that perspective, that's what I find challenging about the project. Or I'm better now, but I did get quite frustrated before at not being able to find a genetic diagnosis for someone. Yeah. But I have really the best mentors and teachers I could really ask for. My PI Jane is absolutely lovely and really reassuring, and my postdoc supervisor Adrian, who has taught me everything I know, has, you know, reminded me that we can't solve it all right now, but that hopefully in the future it gets better, you know. So that's the challenging thing about the project. And then PhD in general is along the same lines. I am a very, how do I put it? I like to do everything, and I like to make time for everything. And I'm a very organized person. So when something goes wrong, I do get a little bit caught up about it. And I think loads of PhD students relate to that as well. I think it's the kind of personality that's attracted to doing a job like that. I think the challenging thing is being too hard on myself. And I really have learned as I've gone along to be easier on myself, but I definitely think I could be even easier on myself.
Yeah. And you've discussed like a little bit about this on your Instagram, and I'm sure you've probably got like similar questions to what like I've got, and people say like, how do you deal with that? So I guess, how do you deal with that? For me, it's something I think that has had to come in time. And I think the more that I failed, the more I realized like, this is part of it, and I just have to deal with it. There wasn't sort of one thing that helped me deal with that.
It's a gradual process.
And I agree with that for sure. I definitely seek kind of reassurance from other people, maybe my seniors and stuff like that, who can tell me they've been through this and this is what happens, and don't worry, you know, we'll figure it out. Guess having a really good support network and things like that. What was the other thing I was going to say? There was something there that you said. You just leave your head when you're talking in a situation like this. What do I do to get through that? Oh yes, that was it. I find actually, and it only really in the last kind of year or so, is that when I'm teaching undergrads in the lab, and I'm telling them, don't worry about this, we'll figure it out, it's gonna work, that I learn I need to speak to myself that way. So they've actually given me a really great perspective on how to approach things, because they might get upset about something and I'll reassure them, and it actually reassures me too, because I'm like,
practice what you preach.
I really like teaching. It's something I really enjoy, and I always sign up for as much teaching as I can. The undergrads are great, because at the beginning they bring a great level of enthusiasm and all that stuff, and you kind of go through the highs and the lows together in a short 10-week project. I really like it, so I really do like supervising undergrads.
We should finish up with, where can people access your paper, contact you, like what are your socials? Her Instagram is amazing.
We will put the link in the description box.
Mention your Instagram handle, definitely. We will put it in the description box, but you have to follow her on Instagram. But yeah, go ahead, reel off your socials, tell us where we can find your paper.
Yeah, so you can find the particular paper we were talking about. It's published in a journal called Genes. It was published in January 2020. And it's called Findings of a Genotyping Study from Over 1,000 Individuals in Ireland with an inherited retinal disease. It's a long one.
We will put the link. We'll put the link in the description.
And yeah, I have Twitter and Instagram accounts where I kind of talk about, you know, doing a PhD and my research and all that kind of stuff. And the handle is @PhD_with_Laura. But you guys will have that below, I'm sure, as well.
Yeah, we'll put everything in.
Laura, yeah. And I only set up the Instagram pretty recently, but it's going well. And do I have anything else? Yeah, you can email me as well. My email is, you can just do phdwithlaura@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it.
And you've also just started a newsletter thing, haven't you?
Oh yeah, so... I do remember all the things I'm doing now. So I send a weekly email and it's got kind of motivational tips and different things about learning how to code or different things like that. So you can sign up for that on my Instagram as well. If you click.
So in conclusion, just go and follow her because her content's amazing. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Yeah,
it was
thank
fun.
You. It's been really, really interesting.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's a great opportunity. I love doing any outreach or anything like that.
Laura loves talking.
It's been really great.
That's so true.
All right. Well, we will see everyone in episode 4.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Laura. It's been really great to speak to you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @TheGenomicsLab. That's got a capital G and a capital L.
You can also find us on Instagram @AGenomicsPhD. And finally, be sure to subscribe to us on your favourite podcast platform.
And we will see you all in the next episode. Thank you again for listening.